Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Wayne Curtis, author of The Last Great Walk, the true story of a 1909 walk from New York to San Francisco and why it matters today. And short story writer Kevin Fortuna, whose new collection is The Dunning Man. A lot of New Orleanians know Wayne Curtis as a cocktail historian, which does indeed sound like a dream job for New Orleans. He's the author of And a Bottle of Rum, and I can personally attest to his skills as a mixologist. But Wayne writes about a lot of things, architecture, preservation, travel, and in his new book, Long Distance Walking. The book is called The Last Great Walk, the true story of a 1909 walk from New York to San Francisco and why it matters today. Wayne, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
You know, it's an odd quirk of mine, but I collect books about walking and pilgrimage, like Rebecca Solnit's book, Wanderlust, and Robert McFarlane's The Old Ways. And this is really one of the epic stories of walking, isn't it?
It is, and it's heretofore been untold by and large. So it was fun to come across it and to be able to dig into it a little bit.
So tell us about Edward Payson Weston.
Edward Payson Weston was born in 1839, and he basically was the grandfather of American long-distance walking competitions. And if that causes you to scratch your head and wonder what it was a real event, a thing that actually happened in the post-Civil War years for about 20 years. At that time, people were betting on everything. The horse racing was in vogue, boxing was coming out big, poker was coming into its own, and there were a lot of long-distance walking races where people would bet on competitions, sometimes long distance. Edward Payson Weston walked from Boston to Chicago in a month with people betting on him all along the way, whether he could do it in the 30 days. And there were a lot of six-day races where people would start at midnight on Sunday and they'd see how far they could walk until midnight on Saturday. Held in Madison Square Garden, the old one. People would line
the
up.
The old one.
Yeah. And pay $10 to come and the equivalent of $10 to come and watch people walk around a track for hour after hour. And he was one of the great stars of it.
That's sort of an amazing thing, isn't it?
It is an amazing thing. But at the time, people would bet on anything, and great walkers were in demand.
Now, you actually retraced some of his steps, didn't you?
I did. The book is about his 1909 walk. He left New York the day he turned 70 years old, and he decided he was going to walk to San Francisco. And
say that again. 70 years
old. 70 years old. He turned 70 years old on March 15th, 1909. And he set off for San Francisco, and his plan was to walk about 40, 41 miles a day, every day except Sunday. He'd promised his mother sometime back that he wouldn't walk on the Lord's Day, and he didn't. So he took Sundays off and rested, but Monday through Saturday, he walked, got up in the mornings, walked all day, ended up averaging just shy of 40 miles a day walking to San Francisco. And I did get into parts of that. I originally thought I would retrace his entire walk, but I decided against that for two reasons. One, I can't do it. I'm just not equipped to do those long kind of days. He did it in 100 days. It probably would have taken me 300 days. I couldn't find a way to do that. And also the terrain on which he walked, a lot of it has now been overdeveloped. It would have been walking past strip mall after strip mall, walking along throughways. And a lot of it would have been walking on train tracks out west, which is the only route that he could really find that wasn't all mired down in mud. And that's illegal to walk on, so it couldn't have tracked him that way either.
Wow. I can't imagine walking for 300 days.
No.
I think you would have been really homesick. But now, one of the things I love, this is one of my favorite descriptions in this book. You say he was a man walking out of the age of romance and heroism and into the age of pragmatism.
It's true. That's really what helped me coalesce the book when I was writing it, was realizing that in 1909, he had tons of people out watching him. About 10,000 came out in New York. There were thousands all along the route that he went out. People would come out late at night to watch him walk by. And I started thinking there was something more going on here than just a 70-year-old guy walking across the country. And it sort of felt like a John Henry story, and that things were transitioning and the car was really coming on strong in 1909. And this really felt like where the title comes from, The Last Great Walk. And I started looking in the fact that more or less spent 5 million years evolving to walk upright and do so very efficiently and well. And over the last 100 years, we've really abandoned that mode of transportation for long distance travel and have moved on to other ways of getting about. And just was curious about the effects on us over that period of the last 100 years. I started looking at the last 100 years as sort of an experiment of something that humans have undertaken, and was wondering what the early results were on that.
Well, one of the things you write about that kind of came home to me recently is you write about how dangerous it was to walk.
For Edward Payson Weston in 1909, it was dangerous. At the time, it was a transitional period, sort of between 1909, I'd say about 1929. Walkers always had ownership of the road. You could walk wherever you wanted. There was no such thing as jaywalking. That term didn't really come around until, I think, in the 1910s. People could walk wherever they wanted. And just then, the cars were starting to come in and get more aggressive. And a lot of people were being hit and killed at the time. So it was a dangerous time to be out and about in this era. Probably less so than today, just because people tend to move faster and they tend to be more cocooned in their cars. But it was still a dangerous time to be out.
Well, I don't know. I saw some poor guy trying to walk down Chapultepec the other day. Hardly any sidewalk, big trucks going by. I thought, oh, I hope you don't have far to go.
Yeah. No.
So one of the things you do write about with great interest is the dire consequences of how moving away from walking has changed us as people.
Yeah, I look at a couple of aspects of that in the book. A lot of it is how it's affected us physically. One of the things that I actually found hard to pin down was how much humans walked on average over the course of several millennia. But what I came to find, or what I came to conclude, was we probably walk somewhere around 8 to 12 miles a day on average, just as a matter of survival, a matter of getting to where we needed to go, finding food, finding shelter. And that has really dropped off. The figures that you see commonly cited now is the average American walks about 2.5 miles a day. And that's just puttering around your house, walking from your cubicle to the bathroom and back. And that's quite a bit less than it seems that we were engineered for through evolution to walk. And that seems to be having increasing consequences. I think the most notable one is in obesity. We've seen obesity rates skyrocket. A lot of that is obviously due to increased access to calories and processed foods. But there's also on the exercise side, we're doing less as a matter of course. And there's been some interesting experiments with the Amish, seeing what they do since they eschew machinery and how much they burn. And it's some interesting studies that are occurring with it.
2.5 miles, that's like barely a lap around Audubon Park.
It is barely a lap around Audubon Park.
Sad.
Yeah.
So I want to know, since you've had to give all this thought to walking, what's the best walk you've ever taken?
Good question. I don't know if there's a single walk that I've really enjoyed, but I've actually come to approach walking through cities much more as if I were walking through backcountry. I grew up doing a lot of backpacking in New England and elsewhere, and I do less of that now, but I do more walks through cities. I like to go out and do an 8 or 10 mile walk through a town. New Orleans is a great place for that. One of the things I like about it is I can combine my interest in cocktails as well. So you can take a 6 or 8 mile walk, stop off at a bar, have a nice drink, and then continue on. It's just sort of like stopping in a spring in the mountains. But I like to walk from uptown down to the French Quarter. I've done great walks this summer at Acadia National Park. There's a great bus system that you can walk through the hills, carriage roads, trails, towns, and then find your way back on the free shuttle buses. Fredericton, New Brunswick, another great spot. And then New York, which is one of the great walking cities.
Oh, yeah.
Particularly, I did a walk a few weeks ago, started off far into Brooklyn and spent better part of an evening walking myself back to Midtown Manhattan where I was staying and visited some friends, stopped off at some bars, crossed the Brooklyn Bridge at midnight, and it's a beautiful walk.
Now, you said that moving to New Orleans, and you moved here in 2006, and you said that is the best thing you've ever done.
It is. Everything about the city appeals to me. Its sense of history. I lived in New England for most of my life, and there's a lot of history there, but so much of it seems to have been interrupted and rediscovered by Convention and Visitors Bureau and resurrected for tourism purposes. In New Orleans, I feel there's more of an uninterrupted line of history, which I like a lot here. I like the architecture, the scale, and the ability to get around by bicycle and by foot quite easily.
Oh, yeah. One of the things I love about New Orleans is the ritual walk. You know, it's like the Mardi Gras walk. Mm-hmm. Everybody has this thing, you know.
And the second line. I mean, the second line, I would go out Sundays and join in on those quite a bit. They've always been mystifying to me. I wasn't sure exactly what they were until I started settling in, realizing it's just a walk with friends and music.
And
it's a way of taking back the neighborhood. You take over the street and you move through and everyone comes out. It's an amazing ritual.
There's a reason that feet on the street is that phrase. It's associated with New Orleans so much. We've been talking with Wayne Curtis, whose thought-provoking new book is The Last Great Walk, the true story of a 1909 walk from New York to San Francisco and why it matters today. You can meet him Tuesday, October 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Wayne, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's time I'm walking to New Orleans. I've got no time for talking.
Kevin Fortuna has a name that's certainly made for a writer, and he's making waves with his first story collection, The Dunning Man. He's a graduate of the MFA program here at the University of New Orleans, as well as a recipient of a prestigious Lannan Literary Fellowship. Kevin, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks very much, Susan. It's a pleasure to be speaking to you today.
Well, congratulations on this fine collection. When The Dunning Man opens, a young man named Connor is on his way to Atlantic City in the story Dead. He's astute and observant, and we wish him well, but odds are kind of stacked against him, aren't they?
Well, they are. I mean, he's in a tight situation, but, you know, I think there is the possibility for redemption.
I hope so. We always hope for that, don't we? Now, these short stories, and there are six in this collection, and especially the title story, they're so unforgettable. So when we meet Connor in the first story, he's on his way to Atlantic City. And when we get back to him at the last story, The Dunning Man, the title story, it's another Atlantic City story set in an apartment complex called the Beach Garden, which features a range of tenants, including tigers and rap stars, and so many other things thrown in that it's just simply amazing. It's a recipe for trouble. And I bet you really loved writing that story and going back to that character, didn't you?
The Dunning Man was so much fun to write. People's reaction to these stories has, you know, as you can imagine, sort of spanned the full spectrum. But, you know, it's been really sort of encouraging, and I think people have had fun reading them, which is great. You know, in the case of The Dunning Man, what's interesting to me is people talk about the story collection being kind of dark, and I think The Dunning Man is a fun roller coaster ride. And it's not dark, at least not to me. I think it's a pretty positive story and a story about redemption, and it's kind of a love story in some ways. But, yeah, the cast of characters is wild. Tim O'Brien, I think, once said in an interview that stories should be about extraordinary things happening to extraordinary people, and I think that's about right. And having been a landlord myself now for a pretty long time, I've had the fortune or misfortune of meeting a lot of really interesting people, some of them stranger than any fiction that I've read. And in the case of The Dunning Man, the inspiration for some of those characters came from, you know, as you can imagine, some real-life characters, although it is pure fiction, but it was a blast to write.
Well, my life as a landlord taught me never to rent to anybody with birds. That was the sum total of what I learned. But you've often said that you find your inspiration for these stories in real events.
Yeah, I think anything that's too far divorced from stuff that you've seen yourself. I mean, at least this is for me. I have a literal mind or imagination. So anything that's too far removed from reality, that it's not at least inspired by something that, you know, meant something to me or interested me in some way, you know, doesn't ring true on the page. So, you know, sometimes it's just a moment, sometimes it's something more than that. But I think in each of these stories, there is some, you know, kind of spark that comes from real life.
Right. I think a lot of these stories will ring true to readers, especially these stories of incredible family dysfunction. And these are usually Irish families, usually families consuming a lot of alcohol. And one of the stories, Sullapalooza, is about a brother who's behaving very badly at another brother's party. And he thinks carnage, trouble. You roll down your window and you can smell it in cold, wet, dirt-soaked air. So you don't shy away from this kind of family carnage, you know?
Right. I mean, I think there's quite a bit of, let's say, over-serving in these stories. Some of the characters do drink quite a bit. Interestingly, though, the title story, Dunning Man, which is almost half the page length of the book, is not really a story about drinking. And it's not a particularly Irish story, although I do think that there's a big Irish-American influence in the stories. In terms of the carnage stuff, yeah, you know, I guess what I tried to do with these stories is make them interesting, is to give them a forward lean. Again, writing about interesting and extraordinary people that don't follow the typical rules and protocols of society. And, you know, in a lot of cases, I think what makes interesting fiction is getting the nuance right and making sure that your quote-unquote good characters aren't only good and your bad characters are sympathetic enough so that readers want to root for them on some level. I think that's what makes the best fiction. Yeah, there are some characters in here that don't necessarily treat their body as a temple, you might say.
So true, so true. Now, the other thing I noticed is that you don't shy away from writing from women's points of view. There's a wonderful New Orleans-set story, Weddings and Burials, and that's told from the viewpoint of Rosie Casey, and she's a woman who's faced her share of tough family situations.
That's right. And, you know, the first thing I'll say about that story is, you know, I have sort of an unfair advantage in that I live in a house full of women. Even my dog is a girl.
You have three daughters, and, don't you?
I have three daughters. I have twins, Aoife and Niamh, and my youngest is Anya. And there's two stories that were written from a female point of view. And
right.
In the case of Weddings and Burials, which was the first of the two that I wrote, I had an idea for a story, and I thought that what I was trying to capture in that story could be most effectively captured through a first-person female perspective. And I was really kind of terrified on some level to try it, but I really tried to get it right, and it is one of my favorite stories in the collection.
Oh, I can see why. I love that character. I love the way she looks at the world, you know. Now, you seem to push a bit at the short story form, but you said something really interesting, that the short story is something that forces you to edit as you write, which I really
right.
appreciated.
It is. I think there's a kind of a platitude about writing short fiction, that it's harder to write a really short story because you've got to, every single word has to count. There's no margin for error. And I think it's a great art form, and, you know, it's been said that it's one of the only truly original American art forms, along with, you know, jazz and blues. And I think it's a great form, but it is hard to write a short story, and revision is something that I wasn't very good at first. But finishing this collection helped me get better, along with really the great guidance I got at the University of New Orleans.
I know. It is a great program, isn't it? Now, one of the interesting things you said, you know, you have a busy day job, and perhaps you'll say a little bit about that, but you don't really have a writing life, what most people would call that. And you write when you can and where you can, and that writing this book was something that was on your bucket list.
It really was. I'll say really quickly, without giving a shameless plug, that my day job involves being the founder and CEO of an internet company that sells wine. And incidentally, even if people don't come for the reading itself, they should come to the Garden District Bookshop on the 28th, because there's going to be free wine, and it's really good wine.
Always a draw in New Orleans, as you know.
So that company is Lot 18, and that's been a hectic job on some level, as all internet startups are. So I've been cramming the writing into kind of lunch breaks and train rides and, you know, business trips where I'm on the plane for 5 hours and things like that. I don't have a typical writing life.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the great things about the University of New Orleans is that it afforded me to finish my MFA, you know, during the summer and online. And it's an incredibly innovative program that Bill Lavender really single-handedly, with the support of some great friends, obviously, but it was his vision and, you know, he really did an amazing job building that program.
And you traveled, you were in the low residency program, so you studied in Scotland and Mexico, but you live part-time in New Orleans, right?
I do have a property down there, and I try to get down there as much as I can, and in a way, I grew up in New Orleans. I went to Jesuit high school, but I lived on the East Coast growing up as well. But I do consider New Orleans home, and I try to get down there as much as I can.
So what's the next book? What have you got underway now?
Well, I've got a novel in my head, and I think that's the next challenge for me is to try to write a novel. And so, you know, I've just got to figure out if I have the time to do it.
Well, take enough plane rides and maybe you'll get a lot of work done. But these are
right.
Fabulous stories. I mean, the voices are so strong and the characters are so memorable. It's really kind of wonderful. And it's very compact. You accomplish a lot in these six stories, you know?
Well, thank you so much for the kind words. It means a lot coming from you, Susan. I really appreciate those words of praise.
Well, it's a world. You can do it. So, well, we've been talking with Kevin Fortuna, whose new collection of stories is called The Dunning Man. You can meet him Tuesday, October 28th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. Really appreciate it.
I love songs about reading and books. They're the musical equivalent of a comfy chair with a good lamp. A to Z by Darren Hanlon from the album Little Chills is a sweet love song to the alphabet, all wrapped up in another love story as well.
Please read me the phone book from Abraham to Zuckerman, all addresses and names, both Christian and Sir. You've my full attention. Yes, I am the lucky one to carry each word from the place it occurred. In my neighbor's garden, I'll steal all the flowers. In the town you were born, I will do a handstand. I'm here, I came down in the last shower with all the subtleties of a marching band. Seated in a lounge waiting to depart, you'd say that we're off to a flying start. Let's capture a city bus, we'll jump from burning buildings, while a circle of firemen catch us in a net. We'll make paper aeroplanes of encyclopedia, from abacus to zebra, the entire set. For those who have matchmaking down to an art, they say that we're off to a broken heart. But there's never an argument I don't need an apology. It's all half a dozen eggplants or six aubergines. Just please sing me the entire Beatles anthology, from all my loving to Yellow Submarine. All my loving to Yellow Submarine. From all my loving to a Yellow Submarine.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Wayne Curtis, signs The Last Great Walk, the true story of a 1909 walk from New York to San Francisco and why it matters today, Tuesday, October 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Addie and Jeremy Martin sign Southeast Louisiana Food, a season tradition, Tuesday, October 21st at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Rebecca Snedeker discusses the One Book, One New Orleans selection, Unfathomable City at New Orleans Atlas, Tuesday, October 21st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Dane Sherman signs Zion, Tuesday, October 21st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Susan Morse signs The Dog Stays in the Picture, Wednesday, October 22nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Della Landis signs Rainy Royal, Thursday, October 23rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. James Nolan signs You Don't Know Me, New and Selected Stories, Thursday, October 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. James Wade discusses and signs The Pito House, a landmark on Bayou St. John, Thursday, October 23rd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Marcus Samuelson signs Marcus Off Duty, The Recipes I Cook at Home, Friday, October 24th at 2 at the New Southern Food and Beverage Museum, 1504 Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. Bonnie Warren and Cheryl Gerber sign New Orleans Homes at Christmas, Saturday, October 25th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Mark Duncan signs All in the Cards, Saturday, October 25th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. The Tulane English Department and Newcomb College Institute sponsor Thinking on the Page, Women in Biography and Memoir, a day-long symposium featuring Patricia Bosworth, Vivian Gornick, Wendy Lesser, and Brenda Wineapple, Saturday, October 25th at Freeman Auditorium, Waldenburg Arts Center, Tulane University. On Saturday, October 25th, Mid-City Library, that's at 3700 Orleans Avenue, hosts its Fall Fun Festival from 11 a.m. to 1. Sidney Pulitzer signs Repair Washington, Practical Legislation for a Constitutional Convention, Sunday, October 26th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Poet Dennis Formento reads from and signs Cineplex, along with poet Lola Haskins, Sunday, October 26th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Today's guest, Kevin Fortuna, signs The Dunning Man, Tuesday, October 28th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Cecilia Casserole d'Artes, author of Jenny Giraffe Discovers Papa Noel, Ryan Adam, author of New Orleans Mother Goose, and Johnette Downing, author of Macarooned on a Desert Island, discuss their work Tuesday, October 28th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And mark your calendars for the Louisiana Book Festival Saturday, November 1st at the State Capitol Grounds in Baton Rouge, featuring such well-known writers as Rick Bragg, Charles Blow, Ernest Gaines, Cokie Roberts, and Louisiana Writer Award winner Daryl Bourke. It's a wonderful event and it's all free. For a complete schedule, go to louisianabookfestival.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.